slightly earlier than usual because I'm right in the middle of two meetings. I've got to go back immediately after this lecture. And can I apologise for having to shift the lecture to Tuesday, because I know it sort of destroys the event. Half the people who normally come can't come on Tuesdays, but I do apologise for that. That's also a force of other circumstances, really. let me just recapitulate where I got to at the end of the last session last week. I was arguing that we're the first generation which, for better or for worse, is living after the end of nature and after the end of tradition, where those terms are understood in an appropriate way. Basically, nature and tradition, my argument is, until relatively recently, supplied sort of fixed landscapes for our actions. Of course, modernity always set itself against tradition, but for a long period there was a kind of symbiosis between modernity in the public sphere, and especially the persistence of tradition in the private sphere, the sphere which I'm going to concentrate on in the lecture today. To talk of the end of nature and the end of tradition does not mean, of course, that nature or tradition disappear. It means that they change their form because, in the first place, of the increasing intrusion of science and technology into the external environment, producing not a world of increasing certainty, but a world characterized in some part by new risk environments, which I discussed last time. The world of tradition changes because the intrusion of human knowledgeability into our own history does not produce the sort of scenario which Marx or Max Weber anticipated. It produces, rather, a world where we have to engage with continuous sources of information to make a life at all. That engagement does not take a fixed form. It takes a fluctuating and difficult form, which also means that in much of our private lives too, we have to think in terms of the notion of risk. We don't so much live in a risk society of the kind which Ulrich Beck, the German sociologist, has sketched out as what I would call a risk culture. The effect of the transformation of nature and tradition is that we have to take decisions about many aspects of our lives that previously were, to some degree, given by these two intertwining arenas of our action, the world of nature and the world of tradition, habit and custom. Now, of course, to say that many aspects of our lives become governed by decisions that we have to take is a complex thing. I would remind you it involves structures of power, and any concrete decision one takes in any particular area of life always exists against the backdrop of, as it were, temporarily frozen decision environments. For example, I might decide whether to buy one computer or another, whether to use one type of word processing system or another, but I did not choose to live in a world dominated by information technology as our world is. There's a very complex relationship between individual moments of decision making and the overall structures which are built on them. This society, however, I think is very different from the earlier form of industrial society, and these transformations have been concentrated in their intensity in a period of something like only about 30 or 40 years. We're going through, in the current period, the consequences of these transformations, which are unsettling the institutions in which we live. They're unsettling them on a global level, and I've talked a bit about that, but I've tried to stress that when one understands what globalization is, it's not just about the emergence of large-scale systems such as intensifying global markets. It's also about the local, the personal, the emotional. Globalization transforms the very conditions of our own personal lives. And it's this end of these two poles that I'm going to concentrate on in today's lecture. What are the implications of living in a globalizing society for the self, for the body, and for personal relationships? I want to propose to you that the changes going on in these areas are every bit as profound, every bit as problematic, and every bit as as a mixture of opportunity and anxiety as the other areas of change which I was looking at in the previous lecture. A world after tradition and after nature is a world of mixed emancipation and anxiety. It's a world of many opportunities, but a world where many new problems face us, which I don't think we have as yet very clear solutions for, either on the level of individual experience or on the level of our collective encounter with the consequences of modernity. Now, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, when Freud was seeking to interpret what the consequences of the early development of modern industrial civilization are for personal life, for self-experience and for the relationship between self and body, he looked towards pathology. He looked to explain normality, as it were, the normal thrust of modern culture, interpretation of modern culture, by looking at pathological aspects of the experience of body and self. And he concentrated especially on the phenomenon of hysteria, about which I'll say more in a moment. I'd like to do the same thing in this lecture, but of course discuss it from the point of view of late 20th century changes of the sort I've been analysing. For me, the secular equivalent, for reasons I'll explain in a minute, of Freud's preoccupation with hysteria has a form of relationship to the body, particularly dominant among young women rather than men, has its equivalent in the late 20th century in the extraordinary rise of eating disorders and the phenomenon of anorexia, such a prevalent part of the experience of many young women in our time. I'd like to use this as an empirical example, as a way of beginning to explore what the implications of the social changes I'm talking about are for the experience of the body and the self. And to me, there's a very interesting juxtaposition here. Max Weber stressed the connection between the rise of industrial capitalism and asceticism, ascetic self-denial, the ascetic punishment of the body. For Max Weber, this, however, was a question of the asceticism of the male entrepreneur. Asceticism is bound up with the origins of capitalism, Weber tried to show. But when Weber talks about asceticism or self-denial, he has in mind a male experience, and he has in mind the experience of the capitalistic innovator, capitalistic entrepreneur. When you look at the phenomenon which Freud analysed, and when you look at the phenomenon of eating disorders in our culture, you're talking here about, of course, mainly about women, not completely about women. You have here a phenomenon of asceticism, anorexia in its extreme forms certainly involves asceticism, self-denial, punishment of the body, but a completely different image and metaphor of modernity from that which Weber focused on. Can I just explain to you how and why I got interested in anorexia and other eating disorders as a sort of exemplar of some of the problems that we all face in this kind of society in which we're living? Simply happened by accident, really, as lots of these things do, I think, in intellectual life. Just happened that one day I got two Sunday newspapers, and each of the Sunday newspapers came with a colour supplement, as they do. Each colour supplement had on the front of it a picture of a young woman starving to death. On the front of one was a black female teenager in Somalia. On the front of the other, it was a white female American teenager. And what struck me is, when you put these two side to side with one another, is that apart from the fact that one was black and the other was white, they looked identical, both on the point of starving to death. And in fact, it turned out in each case, the individual in question did die about 3 months after the magazines were published. And it's as I reflected on this, it seemed to me that even though the physical manifestations seem to be exactly the same, that is, complete emaciation of the body, the social dynamics must have been completely different. In the case of someone who starves to death as a matter of not having enough food, it's pretty plain what's going on. Here you have classical starvation of the kind which is very common in human history. Nothing particularly mysterious in explaining that. It's a horrible thing, but we know why it comes about, and for the individual, person starves to death simply because they don't have enough food to eat. In the case of the starving American teenager, it seemed to me you have completely the opposite dynamic, because here you have someone starving to death in a world where, for the first time, there's far too much food to go around, and where you actively have to pay farmers not to produce in Western societies because they can produce far more than can possibly be consumed. Here's someone starving to death, as a book on anorexia put it, in a sea of abundance. The fact that you can starve to death in such a situation seems, first of all, quite an extraordinary thing, and second, I thought, must reveal something about what's going on in modern societies, quite different from that characteristic of our relationship between food and the body and the self in our sort of society. I then started to look in the history of anorexia and other eating disorders, and it is extraordinarily interesting. If you go back to the 19th century and you look at the people who Freud studied, they were mostly young women. Well, didn't study them, he attempted to therapize them, as it were. They were mostly young women suffering from hysteria. Hysteria was the dominant form of female pathology of the 19th century, where female pathology is understood as a pathology which has no known biological origin, but which does affect the body in a very substantial way. Hysteria in the 19th century, and now indeed, didn't mean getting hysterical in the sense of waving your arms around, so forth. Hysteria referred to, for example, paralysis of the body. A woman wouldn't be able to move one side of the body. Physical incapacities of various sorts, fainting away, that kind of thing. Now, in Freud's time, this was a very, very common phenomenon. The reason why Freud was so impressed with it, and in his early work on using hypnosis, he tried to reverse the condition through hypnosis. The fact that he found this unsuccessful led him on to invent the technique of psychotherapy. Amazing thing, if you look in the history of the 20th century, is that according to orthodox psychiatric classifications anyway, over the course of the 20th century, hysteria seems more or less to disappear. Although it's the prime form of pathology in the 19th century, as you get towards our times, it becomes less and less common, unless you stretch the definition of it to become a much wider definition in terms of which you can sort of put things back in it. Basically, hysteria seems to become less and less common as you advance through the 20th century. The reverse is true for eating disorders and anorexia. Anorexia seems to have been virtually unknown in Freud's time, although his patients, one or two of them, did have manifestations of starvation similar to the characteristics of anorexia today. The term anorexia was first coined in the 1870s, I believe, by a French physician, although there's some dispute about that. It seems as though anorexia, by and large, did not exist before the latter part of the 19th century, although historians dispute this and it's difficult to get clear-cut evidence. Anorexia seems to have its origins in the experiences of so-called fasting women in the midpoint of the 19th century, women, however, who were still fasting for religious reasons. The fasting women of the mid-19th century seemed to be conducting a protest against their exclusion from the official church, in fact, and fasted in order to make this protest felt. If you go back further into history, you do find cases of self-denial and starvation to death on the part of women, but so far as I have been able to discover, always with a religious orientation. Fasting and self-denial, very common in religious groupings of different kinds. Mostly, however, until the late 19th century, this is a male phenomenon. It's usually the male ascetic who goes into the desert and starves unto death. And this is again something associated directly with religious values. The rise of anorexia and eating disorders in the 20th century seems to more or less parallel the disappearance of hysteria. That is to say, up until about the late 1950s, early 1960s, you don't find many cases of anorexia and other eating disorders reported. They're not very prominent. From about the late 1950s onwards, you get an increasing proportion of cases reported, until when you get to the present day, in the United States, for example, University of California campus where I used to teach on, the medical practitioner responsible for students on that campus told me, according to him anyway, one in every three women on the campus during their period on the campus will suffer from what he would define as an extreme form of eating disorder of one kind or another. It'd be too crude to say that the rise of anorexia simply replaces hysteria, that one is a kind of functional replacement for the other, but there's something very interesting going on. That something must, I think, have a social rather than a genetic or biological origin. And I'd like to ask in the course of this lecture how one would explain it. That is, how would one interpret the apparent disappearance of hysteria and the massive rise in the proportion of people suffering from some kind of eating disorder or other? Why are these mostly young women? And would one expect the phenomenon to become generalized? Now, I'm not interested in the phenomenon, however, for its own sake. I simply want to use it as a way of exemplifying certain claims that I want to make about the experience of self, experience of body, and transformation of personal relationships in the kind of society in which I believe we're now living. There are three main sorts of claim that I'd like to make that link up with the points I was discussing in previous two lectures. The first area concerns the experience of self, the second concerns the experience of body, and the third concerns the, I think, tremendous changes influencing our relationships to others in the context of the family, marriage, friendship, and other related domains. This third area, following title of a book I wrote on this, I just call for shorthand purposes transformation of intimacy. Transformation of intimacy, I want to propose to you, is every bit as thoroughgoing as any of the larger scale transformations which we're attempting to face up to at the end of the 20th century. I go through these three points. I'd like to try to relate them to the phenomenon of anorexia and show why they, to some extent, I think, help to make sense of them. First of all, the experience of self, an issue which I think is very important and interesting, but which for reasons of time, I won't spend as much on as I would in a larger lecture context where there was more time to give to it. In a society living after nature and living after tradition, I propose to you, the experience of self becomes different from us, for us, from what it was in previous generations. Essentially, the more custom, tradition, nature are moved from fixing things for us, the less life is fixed by these pre-existing structures, the more it's true that the self becomes narrative in form, that is to say, the expansion of reflexivity, which I discussed last time in a social context, permeates the experience of self more and more. A society living after the end of nature and after the end of tradition, remember, is a society, as I'm describing it anyway, of intense reflexivity, where reflexivity means continually using information about the world to constitute one's activities in that world, thereby reconstituting what that world actually is. That's the kind of world in which we now live. All of this permeates the experience of the self. To have a narrative of self is both a challenge and an opportunity, I think. I don't think it's the case, as if you read many postmodernist accounts of self, that the self in modern society simply evaporates, fragments, breaks up. That's the emphasis of much current discussion of the self in late modern society, fragmentation of self. Not the case, I think. Almost to the contrary, we are forced to know ourselves in a way which was neither necessary or possible for previous generations, but knowing ourselves becomes a matter of constant, active, reflexive work. I first of all sort of coined the notion of the reflexive project of self in a fairly mundane empirical context. I was looking at work which had been done in Sweden, actually, on the experience of women going back into the labour market after having spent some 10 to 15 years bringing up children. And what this research showed was that for these women to get back successfully into a job, paid work after bringing up their children, they had, as it were, to reconstruct who they were as individuals by looking at their past in order to shape a possible future. When they were first of all either married or living together with children, the past was different from how it's now become. That is to say, divorce was less common, marriage was more of a fixed thing, gender roles were more fixed than they are now. As a consequence, the women in this study, the ones who are successful in getting back into the labour market, had to go through a process of self-reappraisal. This process of self-reappraisal, it was pretty plain from the research results, was an emotional one, not just a cognitive one. It wasn't just a case of thinking, well, I used to be involved in a domestic setting, now I have to live in a sphere outside of the family and I have to promote an image of self which is different from the one of the domestic housewife. It was much more of an emotional reworking of the past in order to promote some kind of control into the future. I think that the results of this study can be generalized. What women in the situation are revealed to be forced to do is something I think we're all increasingly forced to do, not just at periods of transition, but as a routine way of having a self in late modern societies. The reason being that having a self is no longer so fixed by fixed points of reference in role structures or given gender divisions or even given phenomena to do with the nature of work and its fixity in people's lives, you have to have a biography. You have to create a biography for yourself. Your biography is not created by the wider social circumstances in which you live, in the sense in which it was even for quite recent generations. This process, I think, has to be an emotional one, and it involves the constant reworking of the past in order to project a possible range of futures for the individual. You do this much more radically in situations of crisis. In a situation of crisis, you can't, as it were, jog along with it in the way in which you can in ordinary everyday life or for many purposes. In a situation of crisis where your partner leaves you, where you lose your job, where you get sick, you often have to undergo a much more radical process of reworking your emotional past in order to confront a manageable future. Now, I think when Freud was looking at his hysterics and when Freud was inventing psychotherapy, he thought what he was doing was producing a science of neurosis. He thought he was showing how you could produce scientific treatment for neurotic symptoms. I prefer to say that what Freud was doing was encountering the emotional undertow of the emergence of the reflexive project of self. That is, what you do in psychoanalytic therapy is you rethink your emotional past in order to restructure an identity which gives you some kind of structured control over your future. Psychotherapy is a way of dealing with time and the emotions, I think. And this is what tradition also was. Freud operated in the early stages of the detraditionalizing of modern culture. Tradition was always about time. Tradition was always about the relationship between one's emotions and feelings and control of time. In a detraditionalizing society, much more radicalized for us, you must take a much more active, interpretive relationship to your past emotions in order to draw a relationship between your past experience and your anticipated future experience of time and emotional involvement. I therefore suggest to you that the rise of counselling of all kinds, I mean, psychoanalysis was an early version based upon a kind of quasi-scientific interpretation of self, but the rise of counselling of all kinds, I would say, so characteristic of our society now, is a material expression of the increasing significance of the reflexive project of self for us. Counselling, I would say, is not, as is sometimes said, simply a middle class toy, and it's something you do when you've got the money and you want to perhaps amuse yourself. Counselling, I would say, is fundamental to a world where the reflexive project of self becomes central. The other side of the rise of the reflexive project of self is the rise of addictions of all sorts. I've done quite a lot of work empirically on the rise of eating disorders, but I've also done quite a lot on the rise of the idea of addiction, and that's very, very, very interesting, I think. Addiction, first of all, is not an old established concept, it's a fairly new one. The idea of the addict is a 20th century idea, basically, not something that existed before. First of all, becomes established in two areas and has again a scientific quasi-biological thrust. First of all, becomes established in the area of so-called drug addiction, which means illegal drug addiction. And then, same time, more or less, the idea of alcohol addiction. By the way, you can't take a Foucaultian interpretation of these things. You can't simply say these are invented by the scientific establishment as addiction becomes medicalized. The truth is rather the reverse. Alcoholism, for example, was medicalized as a specific recognized form of addiction largely through the efforts of alcoholics themselves, who forced the medical profession to take notice of their condition and register it as something scientifically diagnosable. Interesting thing, though, I think, is if you go back over the period I'm talking about, last 30 or 40 years, over that period you find a tremendous expansion of the idea of addiction. I leave it in your hands as an expansion of the idea of addiction, rather than asserting there is a kind of empirical change here. What you find is, especially in the self-help and therapeutic literature, that the idea of addiction becomes expandable to every context of life activity. Not only can you be addicted to alcohol or to illegal substances, you can be addicted to work, you can be addicted to exercise, you can be addicted to going on holiday, of course you can be addicted to minor substances like coffee and so on. There was no, most interestingly recently, the rise of sex addiction, the idea of love addiction, also spoken of in the therapeutic literature. Ideas which at first blush sound absurd, but they're not absurd, because when you're talking about the expansion of the idea of addiction, you're talking about the expansion of the idea of compulsiveness in our lives. I mean, Freud linked compulsiveness to rather specific things, like when you had to make the bed 50 times before you were satisfied with it, something like that. Now we see compulsiveness in some sense invades all contexts of our lives. Someone who is a workaholic has compulsive involvement with work. Work is the main structuring device of that person's activity. The reason for the expansion of the idea of addiction is essentially the two things I mentioned, the retreat of nature and the retreat of tradition. Wherever tradition and custom retreat from areas of our life, there compulsion can enter, because compulsion is simply an emotional orientation to the past. It is a particular way in which the past assumes a fixity for present day behavior. An awful lot more could be said about this. It's one of the themes of our experience of self in modern culture, I think, the invasion of our lives by compulsiveness, the difficulty of finding an edge that separates habit from compulsiveness is a peculiar and prominent difficulty for us. You must establish some lifestyle habits, otherwise it's impossible to sustain an oriented sense of self. You must have some fixity of lifestyle habits. This fixity is by and large not so much supported by tradition and custom as it used to do. There's a very close edge, therefore, between it and compulsiveness. To mention one theorem relevant to the resolution of the issue of anorexia and eating disorders, it's plain that these are a form of compulsiveness. It's plain that anorexia is a kind of addiction, or an addictive phenomenon. It's an addiction which manifests itself through deprivation, but most of the things that anorectic individuals do, for example, exercising furiously 7 days a week, for instance, have this addictive or compulsive quality. Anorexia is somehow bound up with compulsiveness in relation to the body and body imagery. All this, anyway, under the first category of the reflexive project of self, a bundle of really, really interesting issues, I think, which touch on our everyday experience. Second, these things do directly impinge upon our experience of the body. If reflexivity invades the self, such that you can't have a self without an emotional project of reflexively engaging with yourself and deciding who you are, if in some sense we all now have to decide who we are, much the same thing applies to the body. That is, the body increasingly becomes a reflexive project. It's invaded by the reflexivity of the wider society through the impact of the same twin forces. The retreat of nature in the body, the end of nature in the body, as I stressed, I think, in the last lecture, is just as important as the end of external nature. The end of nature in the body is the end of a taken-for-granted body. Insofar as medicine, for example, opens up many areas to human decision-making that were previously the province of nature, you can speak of the end of nature in the body. I offered in a previous lecture, I think, the example of reproductive technologies as a good way of thinking about this, but it's only a one among an indefinite range of forms of impact which medical technology and other forms of science and medicine are having on the body. The body, as I stressed in previous lectures, was always cosseted, was always adorned, was always disciplined, was true of all cultures. In our culture, however, or in our type of society, you have a much more intense invasion of the body. In a sense, the body, if you like, was previously protected by nature and tradition. It is no longer so. As this happens, this has implications for so many aspects of our lives, but to trace it back towards the issue of anorexia and eating disorders, the point of conjuncture historically between the transformations I'm charting out here and the rise of anorexia is a phenomenon I alluded to briefly when talking about globalization of food production. Globalization of food production becomes more intense around about the late 1950s, early 1960s, with the invention of new forms of refrigeration and container transport. Once this happens, you have the rise of supermarket culture. Supermarket culture is a food culture which exists outside of nature and outside of tradition. I take it it's plain that when you go into a supermarket, you see the foods arrayed there. Those foods are not put next to one another according to the dictates of nature. That is, they're taken out of the natural rhythm of growth. You can buy oranges at any time of the year, for example. They're not dictated by traditional diet either. You must pick what you eat. In this sense, I think we can say that in the Western world, even among poor people, we've all been on a diet since about the early 1960s, in the sense in which you must choose what to eat in relation to how to be, as a self and in terms of your presentation of self through the body. The fact that we're all on a diet in Western culture, I take it, is the generalized backdrop to the rise of anorexia and eating disorders. They reflect the fact that we're all on a diet in the context of the particular struggles of young women in a society which treats young women as emancipated, but where young women are still not emancipated in practice. I take it the chief reasons for the rise of anorexia and other eating disorders are partly related to changes in body imagery, certainly. Certainly when you have too much food, it becomes an ideal to be thin, just as in societies where you don't have enough food, it tends to be a body ideal to be rather more rotund. A society which values thinness does so against the backdrop of the increased availability of food, plainly. It's clear that commodification is involved. It's clear that advertising imagery, the imagery of the waif-like supermodel and so forth, is also involved in this. But I think the most profound reason for the rise of anorexia and other eating disorders is simply our altered relationship to body and self. In a world where we're all on a diet, you must make lifestyle decisions in relation not just to your future health, but to your expectation of yourself in relation to your body. You must recognize that this is an active thing. Even if you don't bother, you still, I think, implicitly recognize that this is an active thing. Even not bothering is an active thing. There are no traditional diets anymore, by and large, in Western countries, especially in the more commercialized of Western countries. These lifestyle decisions, therefore, become constitutive of who we are. I suggest that anorexia attacks young women particularly because of the contradictory position of young women in relation to expectations of sexuality and physical appearance in a world which catches them between two countercurrents. On the one hand, massive processes of equalization affecting women, which declares that women, young women, when they enter the adult world, are like everybody else. They should take an active role in their lives. They have equality with men. They, in some sense, are equipped to act like men have always done. But the wider culture, in practice, does not acknowledge, contradicts these expectations. Contradicts it in the sense in which, for example, that bodily appearance, all studies show this, even in the most modernized society like the US, is still taken as a much more important criterion of how you evaluate a woman, both sexes evaluate a woman, than they do a man. Appearance, culturally, still counts for far more in the case of women than the case of men, in terms of how you assess the other individual when you meet such an individual. Sexuality, for women especially, is still in a contradictory situation, where women on the one hand are enjoyed to be sexual beings, and are said to be sexually equal to men, but where the world still tends to be dominated by norms of male sexuality. For these and other reasons, which I don't have time to sketch in, but you might like to reflect upon, the young woman is, I think, in a situation of massive tension in relation to self and body, and it's making that transition from being a child to being an adult, which is means a sexual adult, which explains why the phenomenon of us all being on a diet tends to concentrate this particular age. Anorexia is a phenomenon of addiction in the sense in which it has a spiraling effect. Once you get bound up in an addictive, degenerative, addictive cycle of any kind, it's very hard to extract yourself from it. It's a sort of self-reinforcing cycle of deterioration in relation to the body, the end of which you declare yourself to be still fat, even while somebody else might take you to be completely emaciated. I would just point out, however, that it's not completely illogical for an anorectic individual to call herself fat, because who is to say what the norm of fatness and thinness is or should be in a society where these norms become more and more contestable? You could try to define it by reference to health, and that's what the medical literature on anorexia tends to do. Otherwise, you're in the realm of norms and values, and it's not so obvious that what to an ordinary person seems amazing, that someone who's very thin could still think of herself as fat, it's not so obvious that that person is in a logical sense wrong. One of the interesting sort of features of this the contestable nature of values with regard to the body, I think, in our society. If my analysis is correct, you would expect anorexia to be a phenomenon which doesn't remain confined to young women. I think you would expect it to move up and down the age range, and I think you would expect it to apply increasingly to men. And this is indeed what you do find. The increasing proportion of anorectics and people suffering from other eating disorders are male, and anorexia, like Western capitalism, has this enormously voracious character. It's now seen in girls as young as 6 or 7 years old, and goes up to a much later age range among women than it used to do. Many women in the US in their 40s and even 50s suffering from anorectic symptoms. It's not only anorexia through which you can discuss these things. The same thing applies to aging. Aging is no longer simply something which is experienced as being in the body. Aging is more and more something which you do. Aging is more and more something which is an active phenomenon. It's more and more something which you expect and know to be the result of lifestyle decisions which you take. One reason why our treatment of older people in the welfare state, I think, in the next generation has to be very different from how it's been in previous generations. Third, all these changes refract through the various dimensions of our personal lives. And the family values debate is a kind of political expression of the consequences of these changes. How should one summarize them? Well, what happens in personal life is that you get the emergence increasingly of post-traditional relationships in the area of sexual involvements, marriage, the family, and friendship. How would you characterize post-traditional relationship? Well, I characterize it by means of what I call the emergence of the pure relationship in these various arenas of personal activity and involvement. By the pure relationship, I don't mean a relationship which is sexually pure, far from it, not necessarily anyway. By the pure relationship, I mean a relationship which you enter into for its own sake and which you keep going insofar as it delivers goods and satisfactions which you deem worthwhile for you within that relationship. A pure relationship is a relationship which you stay in for its own intrinsic rewards that it brings you. I mean by the notion of pure relationship an ideal type in the sociological sense. I don't mean to say there are any real relationships in the world which completely fit this model. All I want to say is that in the realm of sexual relationships, marriage, the family, and friendship, our lives increasingly approximate or tend towards the dominance of the pure relationship. Now, what is pure relationship like? Well, a pure relationship, essentially, you can chart its rise by charting out the time at which we first started talking of relationships at all. A generation ago, the main question you could ask any man or woman was, are you married or are you not married? Now the main question I think you tend to ask other people is, are you in a relationship and how is your relationship going? Marriage becomes an expression, as it were, concrete form, particular visible kind of pure relationship, rather than being a fixed status division of the kind it was for previous generations. Now, some very interesting characteristics of pure relationships insofar as marriage, the family, and friendship move towards them. In a pure relationship, you can't depend upon traditional forms of custom and the fixities of nature for generating trust in the other person. By and large, the hold of institutions over pure relationships is much less than it was for previous generations in the form of marriage, friendship, and so forth. Which means that the more domains of our personal life move towards this model, the more they depend upon a model of personal disclosure. The more a relationship resembles a pure relationship, the more you have to open yourself out to the other in order to secure the trust of the other. In this kind of relationship, you must reveal yourself to the other or be prepared to do so. And the other must reveal him or herself to you. This in turn connects with the reflexive project of self, because you must to some extent know yourself, be able to speak about yourself, have a narrative of self, in order to project this to the other person with whom you're involved in a relationship. This means that new forms of trust tend to develop, which I like to call active rather than passive trust. The rhetoric of the rise of the pure relationship is the rhetoric of intimacy and commitment. These are the rhetorics of the self-help literature, which reflexively explores this realm. In previous generations, in marriage, you didn't need to speak of commitment, and people by and large didn't, because marriage already was a commitment. That's why you had shotgun marriages and so forth. The rhetoric of commitment arises with the emergence of the post-traditional pure relationship, which depends upon commitment, which depends upon a form of active trust, with all the games, the anxieties, the power plays, and so forth, which surround this. The same thing is true of intimacy itself. The more relationships tend towards the pure relationship, the more they tend towards a model of intimacy, where intimacy means precisely disclosure of self, both to oneself and to others. Although you could argue there are always contexts in which people were intimate, I think there's a certain sense in which you could say the construction of intimacy is something quite new. Intimacy is not the same as more traditional forms of marriage and friendship, I think. One of the best ways to explore these things is rather than in the domain of sexuality or marriage, is in the area of friendship, which I also did quite a lot of work at one time. If you look at male friendships, for example, you find there's a kind of time lag in the difference between female and male friendships. In the 19th century, many women already, especially middle class women this started with, were already exploring new friendships around a kind of early model of intimacy and emotional exchange. Men, by and large, were not. Male friendships, at least until relatively recently, I mean, this is a gross characterization, but I think empirically, roughly speaking, true. Most male friendships were comradeships or buddyships. In comradeship or buddyship, you're basically friends because you share a common cultural background or common social experience. You're friends because you went to the same school and stay friends. You're friends because you're part of the same sports club. You're friends because you have the same kinds of interests. And these are the medium whereby you exchange the emotional goods that make the friendship. Male friendships, by and large, are refractory to intimacy in the sense in which female friendships have pioneered this form of relationship. Male friendships, by and large, don't involve the same kind of disclosure which so many female friendships do, which is the very basis of such friendships. There are historical reasons as to why there should be this time lag, I think. Now, I'd say that all that's happening here in all of these arenas, going right the way through from parent-child relationships through transformation of marriage, transformation of friendship, is essentially, if you set it in the context of globalization and detraditionalization, is essentially an implicit process of democratization of the personal and the emotional sphere. You can say, by and large, that democracy triumphed in the more public spheres of modernity, but our emotional lives were still largely quasi-feudal or traditional until relatively recent times. The women's movement and other things changed all that. Now we live in an era in which there is a kind of implicit democracy of the emotions, an implicit emotional democracy arising. Let me just explain quickly why I think that's so. One of the things that struck me was when I was looking at therapeutic literature on what a good relationship is, and I was putting that literature alongside formal models of political democracy, I was really amazed to see that the criteria are almost identical, even though they're totally different literatures. You might imagine sort of totally different areas of life. What is a democracy formally? Well, a democracy is a political form in which you discuss rather than issues being settled either by tradition or by force or violence. Democracy has a public component to it. Democracy presumes equality. Democracy presumes discourse. Democracy presumes respect for the other. And democracy, in some sense, presumes not being able to participate, presumes some form of at least exit, whether it be in the form of not voting or whatever, however you choose to use that. All these criteria, it seems to me, are criteria of what a good relationship is, whether it's a relationship to a friend, to a lover, to a husband or wife, or a relationship between parents and children. Relationship between parents and children, I think there is an implicit democratic claim lodged these days, in detraditionalizing family contexts anyway, that even with very young children, the implicit claim is, if you were able to speak to me on the same level, as an equivalent person, engage in dialogue with me, you would agree that how I have treated you is appropriate. I think there's an implicit model of democratization there in family life, and to some extent a real model, because children have more rights than they ever did before. Children speak back much more than they ever did before. Children assert their own independent views much more than they ever did before. Parents don't like it. It is difficult to live in that kind of family system, but that is how the family is becoming. If it's true that there is the potential emergence of democracy of the emotions, very important thing, I think. If this is happening, first of all, democracy of the emotions would have all the limitations and difficulties which public democracy does. It is not a panacea for the problems of personal life, but it is, I think, a distinctively progressive phenomenon. And there is a crucial edge between the possible advance of a democracy of the emotions and the role of violence in emotional and sexual life. Democracy in the public sphere, I take it, is a way of controlling power and controlling violence. You substitute dialogue or talk for violence. The advance of democracy is the substitution of talk or dialogue for the rule of force or the rule of violence. Fundamental question for us in our personal lives, I think, especially if you look at the enormous implications of the equalization between men and women, which is occurring across the world, is can we manage this transition to a post-traditional order in such a way as to advance the theorem of a democracy of the emotions and control violence? I don't think the answer to that is at the moment clear. It is not clear whether out of this system there will come a stable emotional world for us to inhabit. It is not clear whether it will allow us to control especially sexual violence. We don't know whether sexual violence from men towards women is increasing, but there is some indication that it might be. If it is, I would take it, it is a protest against these changes. It is not traditional patriarchy. Traditional patriarchal violence of men against women was different. It was policed by men in traditional systems. You know, Casanova, for example, was a person who challenged not sexual divides, he challenged the rule of men over women, because he challenged the conventions whereby the male order controlled the relationship between men and women, and violence which was used in those circumstances was often male-on-male violence. Casanova types will be punished by other men if they transgress sexual norms. These things no longer exist, at least in westernized cultures. And the question is whether or not there is an increase in sexual violence which is a result of the collapse of patriarchy rather than the reverse. I therefore think that just as there are lots of questions you can ask about the role of public democracy, can it accommodate the cosmopolitan world we've created? Can it? We don't know. We know, I think, to some degree it can rather than on the level of the nation state. We don't know on a global level. The same issue arises in our personal lives. If there is something like a democracy of the emotions arising, can it contain the forces which it has released? These forces are emotional. They center around the role of addictions and compulsions in our lives. And the key question is, can we accommodate the violence which is thereby released? I'm afraid to say both in public democracy and in emotional democracy to the answer to this question, to my mind, remains an open and therefore a disturbing one. Well, I hope to see you all next Wednesday next week for the final lecture. Thank you.